Hey, it's Coach Sarah, and welcome to Range of Change, the podcast where we dive into the pivotal moments of transformation that shape our lives. If you're looking for inspiration, insights, and real talk about navigating change, big or small, you found the right place. I'm an ICF certified coach and a seasoned change manager with 2 decades of experience helping people and organizations thrive through life's hairy moments. Whether you're choosing to make a bold leap into a new chapter of your life, or life is choosing it for you, this community will explore how to not just survive, but thrive through change. Think of this podcast as your guide to becoming more resilient, more empowered, and ready to take on your next big change with confidence. I'm so excited to introduce you all to my friend Jennifer. We worked together years and years ago very briefly. Fortunately for me, she is a close family friend of my husband, so I've gotten the opportunity to get to know her, and she has some really incredible stories. Today, we're going to talk about one of the more unusual and interesting aspects of her life, and I can't wait to talk through it all. Jennifer, thank you so much for being here.
Sarah, thanks for you for asking me to be on your show. This is so exciting.
I am beyond excited. So my first question that I always ask, overall, how do you feel about change on a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being, fear, anxiety, dread, sweat dripping, to 10 being excited, I'm all in, let's go.
I have a nuanced answer to that question. I think when I'm initiating the change and I want the change to happen, like I'm in the 8, 9 category. Like,
okay.
I've decided to do it. I'm excited about what's next. I have a plan to execute it. I'm following through. I think where I'm not as good with change is when I feel like change is happening to me, or there's like decisions that were made for me or situations that have come up that I didn't get to choose, and I have to go to the through the change that comes of that moment.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people struggle with change that they don't initiate. And a lot of us struggle with change that we ourselves are trying to initiate that we want very badly. And then another part of us is like, no, let me stay where it's comfortable. And so not uncommon at all, but very interesting that there are times when you are 9, 10 ready to go, because not everyone gets to that place.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me is once I decide, I've been mulling, I've been thinking, I've been trying it on in my brain and see how it feels. So by the time I get to like, let's launch and take action, I'm running towards that direction.
That's really interesting, because you have successfully maneuvered a lot of change in your life. And it's interesting that you almost use like a visualization technique, that you are preparing yourself and mentally, emotionally, psychologically, you're maybe already in the target state before you start taking action.
Yeah, I think that's right for me. I think part of it is I've noticed that if I just kind of take a step forward, take 2 steps back, it's like frustrating. So I kind of work through all of the hesitation first. And then when I decide, then I commit and go for it.
Amazing. So like I mentioned, we met each other, over a decade ago, both of us working as technology consultants, and you have had many hats before and after that. Mm-hmm. And today we're going to talk about a chapter of your life. I don't want to give too much away, but tell me a little bit about some of the passions that you've had personally and professionally, and how those have steered you through changes.
I'd love to. So I definitely was someone who graduated college with like an idea I wanted to do something, but not sure what. My undergrad was in theater. So I'm definitely I really liked kind of be part of theater productions. I was an actor. I love like rehearsing lines and the discipline of creating a character. And then the eventual like work all together to put on a production. So I realized in my summer jobs, I liked kind of work that was about like doing something and working as a team to execute it, but I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I ended up, like a lot of people around that time, got recruited to help with Y2K issues and technology. Mm-hmm. I didn't really think that I'd end up in technology as a career, but I always felt comfortable with computers, and it felt like, technology was definitely met the hands-on doing part that worked well for me. So yeah, I spent 18 years as a technology consultant, kind of traveling all over the United States, doing big implementations, mostly at statewide clients.
That's so interesting. Because I like how you mentioned that, when you think of what you need in a satisfying career, hands-on, tangible accomplishments is part of it. But I imagine as a former theater kid and major that there is a real creative part of you that needs to be satisfied as well.
Yes, absolutely. And when I was a software engineer, I found coding so creative. I really loved it. I remember telling my parents at the time, being like, it doesn't feel like work. It just feels like I'm paid to do crossword puzzles all day. Like it was just kind of, figuring things out and trying to figure out how to make the code work or how to write code. And I did feel that part was creative, but like a lot of really good engineers, someone notices you have a personality and they end up like pushing you to project management and more of the client facing roles. So that's what happened with my career, but I didn't give up. And I still, even though I majored in theater, I personally never really had any aspirations to try to be an actor full time. I think part of it is I was just too practical, and the idea of like having to find new jobs in like every 3 months, every 6 months, every year, especially for a profession for like female actors, so much is based on how you look.
Yeah.
And I just felt like I spent my whole education like fine tuning my brain. Like, why would I suddenly go into a career that was like a large part based on how I looked? So, I loved doing it in college, but I was after college kind of looking for ways to still like perform, but not necessarily do it full time. And that's how I ended up in improv.
Amazing. So people who are frequent visitors to my blog know that I am a theater obsessive only as an observer, a patron. I love watching theater, comedy, improv, all of it. I have such admiration for people that get up there and do it. And I would imagine that improv is like acting, but like on steroids. Like it's got to be, to my mind, acting is really putting yourself out there emotionally. And improv is doing all of that and thinking on your feet.
Yeah, I came to improv really, I didn't like consciously think I wanted to do improv. What happened was, is I was living in Chicago and I was consulting, and I just, every year or two, I had to change apartments because the landlords would like hike your rent. So I remember I got an apartment right on North and Wells, which just happened to be kitty corner to Second City.
Oh, wow.
So I was like, what's Second City? Like I'd never heard of it. I'd never heard anything of it. So I started researching it online. And I was like, oh, they offer like a conservatory, like they have like public classes and they have this conservatory for people who had a theater background to like teach them how to do improv. And then I noticed that they offered weekend classes, which was key because we traveled like Monday through Friday. So that's how I got started. I was like, oh, well, maybe I'll do that. And then I did it. And of course, when you're a theater major, you play some improv games, but I had never really done that just as a discipline. And even Second City, even though the classes were learning how to improvise, their shows are scripted through improvisation. Like they improvise to come up with a script and then they actually script the shows. So that got me interested in improv. And it was so perfect for my A-type personality. Because of course, when you're an actor, you're like one sliver of the show. I know the actors get all of the the applause and everything. But if you think about it, like you have the actor, but you really have the director making a lot of decisions about how the show is going to go. You have costume designers that are like dressing you. You have lighting people like adding it. You have set designers. Like you are just one piece of a group performance. Well, in improv, you get to be the actor, the director, the set designer, the everything. Like you got to be all the parts. And suddenly what I realized was lacking from my love of acting was that, oh, and then the playwright is coming up with all the words. And I realized I've never been good at memorizing. So that was always a stressful part for me of being a theater major was just trying to memorize the lines. So then when I came to improv, I was like, ooh, like I don't have to memorize anything. So this was good for me.
Amazing. And I seeing the parallels with, the part of software development that you really liked was the part where you were sort of figuring out puzzles and playing around and trying out different things. And as I'm saying it now, like you could use the same descriptors for improv, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely, for sure. And I think there's also a sense of like, you put it on and it's done. Like I always appreciated that of IT consulting is we'd work for months and years to like get the software ready for a go live. And then you'd go live, there were inevitably problems, but you'd go into maintenance. Like it wasn't like you were perpetually stuck in the same, you know, in the same job or the same role or even the same phase of the project. Even our projects were phased. So there was this sense of like, we're moving forward, we're getting to the next milestone, the next phase, and then we're launching. And even though we keep working on it, it's like a different phase.
Yeah, like, so I did change management, of course, and I thought, you know, we're implementing the same software to the, you know, very similar clients, one state government or the next state government. And I thought that it would be very repetitive, and it wasn't, because the problems were all very different.
Right.
How they, you know, define their chart of accounts is so entirely different than this one. And the issues that they have are with their public grants, and these are with, you know, something entirely different. So even though, you know, you would think it's rinse and repeat, it's not the same as an actor who is putting on the same show night after night, saying the same lines at the same times in the same ways.
Yep.
You know, you really had, you know, creative expression.
Well, what I realized about acting, like I loved opening night, but then I didn't really like doing eight other shows.
Yeah.
Because it just felt like everything had been decided. Like the director had specifically chosen like how, where they wanted me to move or what they wanted me to do. We had agreed on like an arc. We had discovered the character and we had decided we were going to portray the character in a certain way. So it was very rinse and repeat. So that's why improv was really exciting. So I did first the conservatory at Second City. And I really liked that and was kind of looking for what's next. So a lot of people get picked out of the conservatory to be part of the Second City tour company. And I did kind of briefly think about auditioning for them. But with all those people in the tour company of Second City, they have very flexible jobs, like waiters, like temp workers. And again, I was like, I don't want to live the life of someone who is doing kind of gig work to you know, support their passion. I know a lot of people do and it's amazing. I just knew it wasn't for me. So I think after I finished Second City, I was put on a project in a different city, in actually Madison, Wisconsin. I was living in Chicago. And it just so happened, like one week I was, you know, I'd travel there during the week and come back to my condo in Chicago on the weekends. And then one week I took, for some reason I didn't have my car, I took the bus. And the bus that went between Madison and Chicago. And I remember like running for the bus and getting there and realizing, oh my God, I have nothing to do. I don't have a book. And, you know, we had one game on our phones. Right. It was like 1999.
It's a different time.
It was a different time. So I remember grabbing like the free weekly paper, you know, from the bus stop of like, okay, I guess I'm reading this thing. It's called what's it called? Is it the Isthmus Reader or the Isthmian Reader? Sorry, guys. But yeah. So I was like, okay, well, I'm on this bus for 4 hours. I'm going to go ahead and read it just cover to cover. Because I was like, what am I going to do? So I was reading cover to cover. And towards the end, I was like, well, I guess I'm going to read the classifieds. I don't know if you remember. They were kind of entertaining. Oh, yeah. For a while.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was just thinking, like, sidebar for anyone younger. These weekly papers were the thing. Every week,
totally.
You would go and get this free paper out of a box. It would show you everything that was going on that weekend. There was no other way to get that information.
Right.
Like, so, yeah.
And then the personals were interest, because it was kind of like Craigslist. Like, people would buy and sell things. Certainly all the dating. Like, people would put ads for dating.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember I was in the classifieds, and I saw that there is a national franchise called Comedy Sports. And they were holding auditions in Madison. And I was like, well, that's weird because I don't live in Madison. But I was like, well, maybe I should still audition because maybe I could do shows like during the week when I'm here for work and then, you know, go back to Chicago on the weekend. So that's how it happened. Like very serendipitous. I saw the ad. I showed up for the audition, and yeah, they gave me a spot on their professional team. I saw that, you know, they only did performances. They did two shows on Friday night and two shows on Saturday night. So I had to like think about like, okay, well, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to have to spend some weekends here so I can perform. And that felt right. And yeah, that's how I ended up doing. I then continued for 15 years. So I ended up doing, I was consulting full time. And then on the weekends, I would perform with this professional improv company. And I did it for 15 years. And I always felt like it was such a good balance between my job that was very formal. I don't think I realized at the time what a conservative field of work it was. But now I can see that I've left, that it was very conservative. It was working with a lot of people. You know, our clients were state government people. So they were also kind of more conventional. I don't know what the right word is, but just maybe conservative is not the right word, but they were just more like systematic or orderly or kind of procedural based thinkers. So I really appreciated that I had the opportunity to, you know, go do this job that felt very important and very difficult. But then on the weekends, I could play in improv and kind of undo all of that like analytical thinking that I had to do during the week. It was really a process of letting go of that when I would step on stage.
It's incredible. I mean, first of all, obviously, being part of a professional performing group is a lifelong dream for so many people. And you were doing it, balancing it with a full-time job and a full-time life. So kudos. I mean, it's like such an inspirational story. But I also love the way that, you know, this really balanced you out as a whole person. That
yeah. And I don't think I realized that what I was doing at the time. And I think that's true about change. Like sometimes you just, you see yourself drawn to something or you want to do something and you might not be able to explain in so many words why you're doing it. But at least for me, once I retired after 15 years, I could see very clearly for the positive, but also some very kind of negative, not the right word, but like definitely it was also for some reasons that weren't as growth oriented that I did improv, I realized. Like there was, it was a mix. Like I can see why I started it. I can see why I did it at the same time as that job. And then when I left, it was like, I don't want to do this anymore. It's like, you know, when kids come out from like outside and they have a coat and they just rip everything off and leave it on the floor. That's how I left professional improv.
Well, yeah. And I feel like you listened to your instincts, you know, like you went to school for theater and you recognized on some level, like I love opening night. And then it loses a lot of steam for me. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a hard thing to process when you're young and you've just invested a huge portion of your young life in a career field, you know, but you put the dots together. You knew like, hey, this entirely different field actually does a lot of things that work for me and I can scratch this itch, but these things are not meant to be forever. I mean, that's part of the change cycle. The thing that is like filling you up one minute is the very thing you need to get rid of the next.
Yeah, that's a good point for sure. I always say that I wasn't good at improv for the first 7 years. I hate to say it, when I was doing improv, there were so few women doing it that just showing up as a female on stage was kind of enough to get by. Like you didn't have to be particularly talented because they're just like, there's a lady on stage. Now it's now at least in Madison, Wisconsin, it's much more balanced. But for me, it was like, yeah, I did it for 15 years and it took me about 7 years to actually get good. And what really need, it took me 7 years to actually trust improv as a discipline and to really, I knew intellectually to do improv, you have to let your kind of monkey brain take over. You have to actually quiet your conscious mind and kind of let your subconscious take over. But I think for years I was like, but I'm smart. I know that if I think really hard, or maybe even if I think about things during the week that would be hilarious then I can just incorporate them when I'm on stage, and it's going to bring the house down. Because I didn't really trust the, like, it seems so haphazard to, like, trust an entire performance on no planning and no real conscious thought.
It's so interesting. And I think there's so many parts of life that work that way, that when you let go is when it gets easier and stronger and better. In the book Radical Acceptance, Tara Brach has an opening chapter about, and I'm going to butcher this, but pilots, maybe when they first started interacting with G-Force, anyway, so, you know, they would try really hard to, like, muscle through it. And eventually they figured out that you just had to go with what was happening. And that was the path of ease was the right way to get through it. It's a terrible paraphrase.
But it makes a lot of sense. And that is a perfect parallel that you've drawn, because that's exactly how improv works. Is you are much better off, like, kind of trusting the subconscious group energy and kind of focus and kind of the subconscious group brain to kind of take things to where they need to go. And if you actually look at improv, when it goes bad, it's because someone's thinking too much or someone is not trusting the kind of group dynamic and is kind of going off on their own tangent. You know, I mean, you do develop in improv, you develop a lot of tips and tricks to get things back on track. We try not to bomb, but that's a big, you know, anyone who's been in improv and written for business, you know, you learn about, you know, turning phrases like yes and kind of probably the number two adage that improv has given the business world is to, like, to just get really comfortable with bombing on stage, because it's going to happen and you have to. The worst thing you could do when you bomb on stage in improv is like let the tragedy of the experience wash over you energetically so that the audience is like in physical pain watching you. Like, really the best way to recover from a bomb or when it's terrible is to kind of lean into it and how bad it is, and then giving people, actually letting the audience feel like, it's okay, we do this all the time. That was terrible. Right. And I feel like that using that key in the business world works really too. Like when you have difficult news to tell a client or you have a difficult situation, like the more you like hesitate and like you talk around it, it is worse than just like actually saying like, ah, we missed the mark. And let me tell you how we're going to fix it.
Right. Absolutely. And I think that it's almost like a lesson for life itself. Like if something is so hard, if you're just like muscling into it so much, then something's off. But if you can trust yourself, the system, whatever system you've put in place for your life, that, you know, it's not always going to be perfect just because you have a great system or you really believe in yourself. Sometimes there are dips and then you're right back up again, and believing that and being able to shake it off is so powerful.
Yep. I believe that for sure. But it was interesting what happened is I ended up leaving consulting and I ended up moving into video games, which turns out was actually the perfect career for someone with artistic theater background and technology background, because it's really the marriage of those two disciplines. And it was just a couple months after I started that I just threw off my coat and like in one weekend decided I was going to retire from improv. And it was really interesting. It came like so quick. I wasn't planning like, oh, I'm going to do improv for 15 years and then I'm going to retire. No, I had no idea. But I think as soon I made a realization, I think one thing, moving to a career that was much more creative, kind of negated the need to have this thing in my life to balance this like very hard, cerebral, conservative work environment I was working at. But the other thing I realized is that I had been so attracted to theater and improv my whole life, because when I was in playing a character on stage, I had no problem feeling all of the feelings and being fully self-expressed as a person. Mm. And somehow in my personal life, like me, Jennifer, off stage, I was not able to do that. I didn't allow myself to feel the whole range of emotion. And I was not fully self-expressed. Like I kept a lot of my opinions to myself. Like I very much am a people, or was more of a people pleaser than I think I am now. And I was kind of always trying to like figure out how I should behave instead of just behaving. So once I realized that improv was, you know, I think for years I thought, oh my God, I'm so exciting. I live on stage and I play all these characters who do all these things. But then when I actually connected that my life was going to the same pizza basement for like over, you know, for 15 years, performing for people that they were enjoying their birthdays, they were enjoying their anniversaries, they were here for, they were at my show to celebrate their bridal engagement or their, you know, they were celebrating these big life's events. And I was still the chump on the stage at the pizza basement. Like I realized that a lot of my relationships had been so centered around improv. Like I wasn't going out. Like I was celebrating my birthday in the pizza basement. Right. Like I actually, my actual life wasn't nearly as exciting or fully expressed as the characters I was playing on stage. And I was like, wait, I actually want Jennifer me to be in the world, having huge adventures, having all the feelings, like meeting all the people, like not playing characters that were doing these things.
Wow. I mean, it's such an amazing realization to have for yourself. And I'm curious if you feel that it, a lot of it was finding that next job that really freed you up, or were there other things going on that allowed you to say, okay, I'm giving myself permission to live fully off the stage as well?
For me, I don't think that realization or that moment of change would have happened if I had stayed at my old job.
Yeah.
Because I think the other thing too, is while I was doing this difficult work and you know, I did enjoy a lot of it and it was hard and I was proud of the work that I was doing. I realized I couldn't let that be my full identity. So I needed to have this other thing. So I did this serious, hard government consulting work, but I was the woman who did that, but also did improv.
Yeah.
So once I transitioned into video games, I felt like I didn't need to like have this story or have this, like, I didn't need improv to be such a huge part of my identity, because I felt like being in the video game industry, it actually very represented all the parts of me, which are both creative and artistic, but then also kind of business process, organization focused.
Yeah. I love that you use the word story, because I feel like oftentimes all of us get invested in a story of ourselves and yes, something that works on paper, so to speak. Like, well, I'm balanced. I do this and I do this and everything works. But like your body is telling you, this isn't really working for me anymore. And it's difficult sometimes to like lean into that and give up the story and the identity and the narrative that has kept you safe.
I remember I was online dating at the pond. I was like, if I can't put improv comedy on my profile, who's going to want to date me? Turns out everyone would prefer to date a woman who's not in improv comedy. So, that was an unfounded fear. Sure. But it was very much part of I wanted to have an identity of someone who was creative. And I felt like if I gave up, I think I never even considered leaving, because I was like, that's my creative thing. But it wasn't serving me.
Fantastic. And so you found a career where you are fully actualized. You get to fully express all of your different parts. And I happen to know that you're out there living a big life, doing big things.
Yeah, I think so. I think even though I'm not necessarily on the creative, like video game design side, I'm very much on the business side where I do all of our partnerships and, you know, we do all custom work. So there's just a process before we even start working with them to kind of understand what they need and to pitch them ideas. But I think not only is my field of work in general so creative, but it made a huge difference for me working with creative people. Because I don't think I realized it when I was at CGI, but there were entire parts of my personality that I had decided weren't appropriate to bring out at work. Or maybe the work didn't bring it out either. You know, our work was very a certain way. And And I think being around a bunch of people that, you know, creativity runs through their bloods, and like kind of having a creative opinion was kind of their profession, suddenly gave me the permission to kind of bring all of myself to work in a way that I really hadn't for the first 18 years of my career.
Yeah, no, I hadn't thought about that, but the career field itself, like you said, state government work tends to be regimented by the book. Those traits are rewarded. Consulting is very much about, you know, pleasing the client and stay within the lines. No one's looking for broad creative streaks, you know, predictability, repeatability. So, moving into a field where very different things are rewarded and expressed and you see them every day, just being in that milieu allows you to just naturally, I think, express those things more.
Yeah, even just dressing differently. Like I know for years in consulting, I pretty much wore a suit. Mm-hmm. And then the whole industry transitioned to more like business casual. But it was like, I literally remember shopping for work being like, kind of like, well, what would like, you know, someone who did consulting wear? Like, I never asked like, what would I wear?
Right.
Like, it was always like, well, what should I wear? What should I put together to like be appropriate at work? And then I remember showing up to my new job in my old work car, I was being like, this is what you wear to work. And I was like, this is not what we wear to work. Yeah. So then there was even just a it felt like it had to, like how I dressed unraveled, because suddenly there were no rules. I remember my first week, I was like, there are literally people coming to work in capes, like, you know, like hooded capes. And I was like, I really need to think about, like, you know, how do I want to express myself through my clothes and my appearance at work? Because there's no longer the same rules. Like, I think there's a lot of people who are willing to be in consulting and be fully self-expressed. And I just, for some reason, decided that wasn't what I was going to do, which maybe is the lesson too, you know, that there maybe I could have been fully self-expressed at work and it would have gone just great.
Yeah. And I didn't mean to interrupt, but I experienced the very same thing. I felt like I was playing a part when I was in that world. I didn't feel like I could fully be myself. And it's not that anyone ever discouraged me actively or, you know, in any other microaggression sort of way. But there is, I think if you're a certain kind of weird theater type, like there's a certain way that you just understand that that part of yourself is not going to be fully appreciated in that environment.
Yeah, for sure.
Amazing. Well, this is a fantastic story. I have learned so much from you over the years and just watching you take big, bold steps and do things that I find wildly brave and impressive. And I'm so thankful that you came on to share your story today.
Tara, I'm so glad it's such a like privilege that you asked me to be on your show. I really, and same to you as you're like blowing through your different phases of life. It's really impressive. Thank you. Oh,
thank you so much.
Wow, what a journey. This conversation is such a powerful reminder that change doesn't always come from a single bold leap. Sometimes it starts quietly, with curiosity and a sense of creative longing. What stood out for me was how Jennifer prepares for change from the inside out, mentally rehearsing a new life long before stepping into it. That kind of inner readiness, that visualization of the target state, helps transform hesitation into momentum. I also really admire Jennifer's honesty and self-awareness around letting go, like pilots adjusting to G-force or improvisers trusting the scene, how this is often the counterintuitive secret to better outcomes. She discusses the liberating realization that she no longer needed improv to express her full self once she entered the video game industry, a space that just naturally fused her creative and analytical sides. This shift allowed her to retire from improv and pursue self-expression in her everyday life, not just on stage. How cool has her career path been? It's a testament to the idea that you can honor every part of yourself, your creativity, your practicality, your ambition, and make it all work together. The through line for me? She didn't wait for permission to explore new passions. She trusted her instincts and made space for reinvention, even when that meant saying no to a path that others might dream of. It's a vivid example of designing a life with intention, rather than defaulting to what's expected. So if you're in a season of shift, personally or professionally, I challenge you to ask yourself, is the version of success that I'm chasing still mine? What am I clinging to that no longer fits? And where might I invite more curiosity, connection, compassion into the process? Thank you for listening to Range of Change. If this episode moved you, sparked something, made you rethink your own path, share it with someone who's navigating a turning point of their own. And until next time, keep leaning in. The Range of Change is where the real story unfolds.